Hello, everybody. This is William Del Pilar, and this is Fired Up, your source for Friday night conservative talk. And we have a good show for you tonight. We're going to talk about Ukraine and Russia, as we've been talking over the last 3 weeks. But it's a fast-moving situation, with the latest issue being the ceasefire and the terms. And you know what? I sent Jamie. He's our GOP strategist here, who's going to join us. But I want to also talk to him about one aspect of how today's social media and the internet has kind of peeled the layers back. We're taking these leaders literally. They are negotiating literally in public. So today I saw, oh, Putin's demanding this, damn him, damn that. Putin's just laying it out on the line. This is where negotiations start. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit in terms of the issues that causes. We're going to talk about Tesla under fire and domestic terrorism. You know, I never heard one thing from my leftist friends, my progressive friends, my Democrat friends, my libertarian friends, not one of them talking about when the DOJ said people going to school board meetings who happened to be conservatives were domestic terrorists, despite the fact there was not one documented issue of violence at those. So we're going to talk about Tesla and how Trump is going to go after these individuals as domestic terrorists. And then we're going to talk about Mahmoud Khalil and his detention. This is a tricky issue. People want to say there's pros and cons. No, there isn't. This is our country slowly, our values being taken away. Any freaking immigrant will tell you, you don't allow them to do what they're doing because you will lose your country. Why? Because 99% of the time, immigrants saw that happen to their country. So we're going to talk about that. Then we're going to get into our world-famous hot takes. Well, not quite world-famous, at least in my mind, and I think worldly, so maybe that counts. But anyway, before we get into that, I want to welcome my guest, Jamie Miller. For all of y'all, for those who don't know him, GOP strategist, over 30 years in the business. And Jamie's got a couple feathers in his cap. He's met, talked to Trump, given him some advice. But what I find more prideful is he was involved in the 2000 recall election, or not recall, but ballot recall when Al Gore went into Florida trying to what's the term, Jamie? What did
recount
they call it now?
Recount.
Yeah, it was a recount then. But what do they call it now? He was trying to flip the election, is what he was. Voter election interference. They were creating election interference. And to the audience, the most famous shot I'll never forget is when that old guy with the glasses just looks at the ballot. He didn't vote for president, but voted out, voted VP and voted something else Democrat. So they assumed it was a Democrat vote for Al Gore, and they counted it. That's when I knew liberty was being lost at that moment, and I see that happening now. So how are you doing, Jamie?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. What do you got cooking on your end?
Florida is in the middle, not the middle, the beginning of our legislative session. So there is plenty of red meat. And, you know, Florida has been a bastion of conservatism for most of my career. I started my career with Democrats in charge. And by 1998, we took control of the state house, Senate, and governor's mansion. And we have not let go of any of those during that 27 years. So, We're pretty proud of that, and we've grown our majorities in Congress. But so a lot of people, especially conservatives, look to Florida of what is going to be cutting edge and what can pass in their states. And so there's a lot of there's still some election laws going through the process here in the Florida legislative session. Certainly education reform is a big deal. Juvenile justice reform is a big deal. So we have a lot of and one of the interesting things, William, and a lot of people don't give Republicans credit for this. There's a lot of clean water, beaches, saving land that is a huge deal within the Republican caucus here in Florida. So a lot of Republicans don't get credit for those efforts, but they certainly happen here.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that about what can be passed, because there was in my state, California, at one time how California went is how the nation went. And now Republicans are looking more towards what's Florida doing you know, to make things happen. I love Florida. I used to live there in Jacksonville, and ironically, I'm a diver, and that's still, you know, you think it's in, I've traveled around the world to dive, and I haven't gone to Florida, which is in the U.S. to dive. So that is one of my spots I do plan. And I'm always telling the wife that, hey, if we leave California, we're heading to Florida.
Yeah. We have some great spots here on the west coast of Florida as well. Of course, we have a coast there east of Orlando that we call the Treasure Coast because of the number of Spanish ships that went down. And every once in a while, you do hear of someone finding a coin that comes up on shore, even to this day. So,
well, yeah, I'm from North Carolina. We have that off of the little sand chains. We have a chain of islands off the coast of North Carolina, tons, over a couple hundred shipwrecks. You know, people don't realize North Carolina was actually one of the pirate destinations, and a lot of people who were pirates, their families and themselves settled down in that area. So a lot of rich history on the East Coast that Hollywood just tends to seem to ignore, you know? But so that said, let's get into this. Oh, before we do, though, to my friends out there and our fans, autographs are not coming anytime soon, but you can like and share this podcast and make sure you head on and bookmark grumblingsmedia.com. And you can follow us on YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, ePandora with the handle Grumblings Media. Okay. The admin stuff's taken, put away. Let's talk a little bit about Ukraine, Russia. The ceasefire here. And the reason I want to talk about that is obviously because of the ceasefire. So a U.S. brokered 30-day ceasefire proposal has been accepted by Ukraine. It has not been accepted by Russia yet officially. They sound like they're on the verge of it. The war is now in its fourth year, Jamie. The invasion at 2022. Russia's now controlling 20% of Ukraine, and because Trump stopped the shipment of arms, but more importantly, stopped the intel, which they say they restarted. But in that 1 week, Russia was able to do a lot of damage. And I think that forced Zelensky to the table. Ukraine says they want peace. I believe the people want peace. I believe, as Big John, our producer, was saying off camera, Zelensky may not want peace because he's king right now. And so how significant is Trump's personal investment in trying to make this ceasefire happen? Because they're trying to say, hey, he's giving mixed signals. I don't think he has. I think people are taking his words and comments literally as much as those are just negotiation terms he's throwing out for both sides to consider to get him to the table.
Yeah, I think that people do misunderstand his political public rhetoric and that's separate from – you know, maybe what he, the private negotiations. So, there's no question that Donald Trump is most likely the most transparent president we've had in the television age at the very least, probably potentially in history. And I think you led the hour off with, you know, Donald Trump is, you know, and Putin as well. All these negotiations are happening in the kind of the public eye, you know, on Twitter, on all these other social media platforms. And so where people used to use the mainstream media to, quote, fly a trial balloon, that trial balloon's now being flown on social media, podcasts like this, and radio shows. And so it's kind of a little bit of a different world, but I agree with you. I don't think anything is done until it's done. I think there's no question that Donald Trump ran on bringing peace at the border at Ukraine and Russia, and I truly believe he intends to do so and will do everything in his power to try to make that happen.
Oh, I agree. So let's look at – we're talking in broad terms with the audience. So this 30-day duration – let's say once Russia accepts, it kicks in. I think it's a double-edged – people are asking, is it a double-edged sword offering relief to Ukraine? and some are thinking that, hey, Russia could take advantage of it. My take is this actually helps Ukraine. They are literally on their last legs. It gives them a chance to get a reprieve, kind of talk the troops out of deserting. You know, they have more to gain, I think, in the 30-day in case there's any shenanigans to be had than Russia, who I think is just entrenched and biding their time. So how do you view the 30? Do you think?
On my YouTube channel, I was on BBC Live when news broke that Zelensky had agreed to the minerals deal. And I was actually appearing for a different subject and then got kind of thrown into the wood chipper with, BBC International. And even at that moment, that was prior to the Oval Office blow up. But even in that interview, twice that in a three, four minute interview, the hostess asked me twice about, does Donald Trump know that a peace deal has to include, you know, security? She kept using this word security twice. And then we fast forward a few days to the Oval Office blow up. And that's when that blew up, was when Zelensky kind of held his feet to the fire. We know that that was an economic deal that Zelensky was then trying to push into a military deal. And so I have the belief, and maybe I'm in the minority, maybe I'm wrong, but I still believe that Zelensky meant American boots on the ground when he said security, so much so that after the Oval Office blow up, he made a deal with France and Britain, and boots on the ground, EU boots on the ground is included 30 days after the ceasefire. That's one reason why this 30 days is such a big deal, because Zelensky gets some level of peacekeeping troops after 30 days. And, Zelensky, I truly believe he wanted American troops because he knew if Russians broke the ceasefire with American troops on the front lines, that it would be, that was his one chance to kind of reclaim this land.
I agree. And I don't think you're wrong. I think that's exactly what he wanted. I think that's what, you know, look, we're all Trump fans, but I view J.D. Vance as the intellectual powerhouse there, and understanding that Trump is more of a common man in the sense of how he thinks, a businessman, whereas J.D. Vance is an intellectual who understands both sides completely, where Trump will take certain things literal. And I think having
– if you think of their upbringing, you would think just the opposite, but I agree with you, William.
Oh,
you
know, exactly.
J.D. had this very humble upbringing. Donald Trump kind of had this very privileged upbringing. And yet, I think you nailed the nailed the hammer on the head, or
yeah,
whatever, whatever. I missed that.
The hammer on the head. Big
job.
You can always correct us. But and I think J.D. Vance recognized that. So let's talk about here. I want to take it one at a time, and I'm not even 100% sure on based off all my research and what I heard on Russia, because everything's moving so fast. Obviously not Russia, but Ukraine. So Ukraine's going to accept the 30-day truce along the entire front line. They're going to halt military operations, aerial, naval, and ground attacks. And this is all based off the outline of the U.S. proposed plan. Now, this is where it gets murky for me, because they insist on specific measures. And I don't see Russia having an issue with this, the release of prisoners of war, the return of children. I don't know if they'll get the prisoners of war, because Ukraine is hurting for men. So those men will be released back to the Ukrainians, probably to be resent back out to the front line. So if I'm Russia, I'm like, that's a non-starter, and vice versa. But I could see the children. I don't know much about – I haven't researched that much in terms of the being abducted by Russians. Humanitarian access to occupied areas, he wants that. You know, that's a big wish list. I'm like, you're in the middle of a war. You know, it's kind of like a boxing match, like the bell rings is what I'm reading out of him. But he demands a robust Western-backed security commitments, what you were saying. And I'm like, that's what he wants long-term. But in 30 days, I don't see him getting it. And obviously, his eventual goal is NATO membership, foreign troop deployments, as you were saying, in international agreements. And we're going to get to what the NATO bigwig said earlier today or yesterday. But he wants, in essence, to stop Russian aggression. And I get that. What I don't get is he's still kind of demanding that they get out of those territories. I want to toss you these numbers to you. So they've taken over about five territories in terms of names, you know, districts, provinces, however they do it. We call them states or regions, I guess. But so they have Crimea. Obviously, that's where the sub bases are at. But that's 65% ethnic Russian. Donetsk is 48%. Luhansk is 47%. So those three are literally 50% or more Russian. I don't see Russia giving that up. But for negotiations, Kherson is only 20%, and they've taken that region over. And Zaporizhia is 25%. So I can see negotiations, you know, because Russia's going to have to give something for Ukraine to save face. I could sit there and see them giving that portion up. What's your take on their security guarantee demands? Are they realistic, or is this a pipe dream? And you know, let's start with that.
I think one thing that, and you've mentioned it, is that Donald Trump is a practical application president. What's the practical application of this? And the truth of the matter is that these two sides can stay where they are and shoot across this line of, you know, and both sides, if they advance, have major losses. And Zelensky is in a position, I think, where he can't force Russia out of the places they've taken, not without really creating a World War III, which is, you know, because if we put boots on the ground, EU puts boots on the ground, and we start fighting to push Russia back, that is going to be the catalyst for North Korea and China to join Russia in the battle. And that is the one thing that we as just humans in the world cannot afford to let happen. We cannot allow Russia, North Korea, and China and Iran to ally themselves against the rest of us. That's the line in the sand we have to draw. And so the question is, can Zelensky negotiate his way into some of this land back, and Russia keeps some of it? And the answer to that is possibly, but you know, he's not going to be able to militarily take this land back without major casualties. And I don't believe he has the ability and the manpower to do it. I'm not a military expert, but the ones that I've talked to seem to think that he doesn't have the ability to do it.
Well, you know, it does. I always tell people some things doesn't take a rocket science. You don't have to have gone through the war college. That's where the military sends a lot of the people to learn about this stuff, the war college. And
I'm actually a graduate of the Air Force, a civilian graduate of the Air Force's War College.
Oh, there you go. There you go. So you do have the ability to talk about this.
Not really. It's a high honor, but it's a civilian honor, not a military one.
So that's why I was bringing up Kherson and Zaporizhia, is because they're at 20% Russian ethnicity and 25%. And I can sit there and see them. Now, what we haven't discussed and what neither one of us probably know is strategically what they won't give up. For example, Crimea. I mean, that's an easy one, but that's, you know, that was their whole sub base. Their whole everything was there, so they're never going to get that back. But for all the other land places, land regions, we don't know. I guess we're going to have to wait and see. Now, is there any way? He's got to save face here. I'm not worried about the prisoner releases and children's things. He's going to try to publicize that to get sympathy. I don't think it'll work, but do you see any way Ukraine can balance accepting the ceasefire without looking to be conceding to the U.S. and Russia? I think that ship has gone and sailed, but I figure I'd like your input on it to see if there's any way out for him to save face and to look strong.
Yeah, you know, it would take his European partners to help him with that. And so I don't know how much skin they're willing to put in the game. Right now, it seems like EU ground forces are committed on day 31 after a ceasefire.
You know what? I'm not pushing back, but it's not that there is no disagreement or who's right, who's wrong. I'm like, I believe that. when I see it. And if there's ever going to be a reason for a snap election or whatever term they have in the way that they run their governments there, that'll happen in many of these countries. Cause I don't think that people want war. I think they're trying, not to mention they don't even have enough boots to maintain a long-term presence and fund that. So again, and I'm not saying that the be devil's advocate, that's fact. They just don't have that in place. So I think it's more talk right now, but who knows? Maybe they could finagle it, scrap it together.
I don't think there's an appetite to militarily push Russia out of the territories it's taken, I think is the bottom line. And whether that's the EU or the United States, Great Britain, I don't think that there's, I just don't believe that appetite exists, William. And I could be wrong, but I don't think it does.
I don't think this is like World War One, a powder keg waiting to happen. Of course, the way their leaders talk, it is. Okay, so Russia's side. See, this is what Russia has wanted since the late 90s. You know, it's Ukraine abandons their plan to join NATO, agree to demilitarize. Now, that I don't see happening, but they don't want – see, I can see them not joining.
You have to remember too, William, that Joe Biden turned his back as Russia said they were going to invade Ukraine and turned his back on Ukraine until our European partners were like, hey, are you not going to do anything? Are we just going to sit there and let Russia take over this entire country? And, you know, so a lot of this is still, you know, the hangover from the Joe Biden administration.
Oh, right. I see that. Now, on the flip side, nobody's talked about this, Jamie, and it's not on the notes here, but what you said triggered my memory. Ukraine is now the most militarized country in Europe, you know, with all the weapons. Their military is bigger. I'm not going to say stronger. They may not be able to man it with everything we've been sending them. So for Russia to think they're going to demilitarize them, I think that's a big ass. And to me, I'm like on Zelensky's side in the sense, you don't give that up because Russia has a deep history. When I was researching this for another topic a couple of weeks ago, of over the past couple hundred years invading all these regions at one time or another. So I don't see that happening, but they also want a mechanism to monitor the ceasefire. They want veto power over enforcement. So in essence, they kind of have the cards here. You know, they also regained full control of Sudza in Kursk. So they were able to push forward. To me, I guess my question here is, as their list of demands, is it a genuine negotiation baseline or is this them trying to be the strong arm person because they're in control?
Yeah, I do agree with you about demilitarization. That's a tough one. I would have a tough time kind of asking Ukraine to do that after they were the ones who were invaded and have done a pretty good job of holding their own and keeping Russia at bay. So to say, you know, I see where Russia's coming from. If we're going to have a ceasefire, we want to make sure that Ukraine doesn't turn their guns back on us and restart the war. But I think that's where we're at. So that's for someone a little bit more seasoned in the intelligence community than I have to determine if that particular one's going to make it across the line.
Well, they have momentum because of their Kursk victory, and I think they're thinking of twofold. They're entrenched and dug in. See, I don't think they've been sustaining the casualties the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense is telling the UN, you know. And I think they just have purposely entrenched and they're waiting it out. But I do wonder if that victory in Kursk made them realize we can go in. On the flip side, they understand when the Americans turn the intel and those satellites and those planes overhead and the drone ability makes it a bit harder. So before I go on to some of the indirect aspects of this war, how do you see this ceasefire playing out?
You know, I think it can play out just fine if we can get an agreement. I do think that there is a level of respect from both countries towards President Trump. Maybe neither one of these men like Donald Trump, but I think they do respect him and they respect what he says, and that, you know, that we're not going to stand by and continue this war or allow this war to continue. And we want these folks to get to the peace table and have a lasting peace in Europe.
Gotcha. Okay, so you already touched on it, and you kind of said before the audience one final time here, Macron wants to back Ukraine with more and greater guarantees. So we talked about it. Do you see them being able to scrape boots on the ground or a peacekeeping force or anything of that note and putting that, I don't want to say in the front lines, but putting those within key spots in Ukraine?
Yeah, I think on day 31, they're probably not a peacekeeping force, but you alluded to it. It's probably a humanitarian force to exchange prisoners, exchange wounded, that sort of thing. You know, I don't know that they'll call it a peacekeeping force, but there will be some level of international presence.
So, okay, so do you think the U.S. will give Europe a seat at the table in all this? I mean, right now it's just the U.S. talking to Ukraine and Russia. They're taking the lead. I'm sure they're talking over the phone. But right now we haven't heard anything from – we've heard the Europeans talking from their end. We've gotten together. We've done this. We've done that. But Russia's only listening to the U.S. right now or talking to the U.S. Do you think the U.S. will openly give them a public seat at the table, meaning, hey, we're talking to the Europeans that are now involved? Because we haven't heard that in terms of an official declaration from Trump. Hey, the Europeans are at this table.
Yeah, my experience is as transparent as this administration is. There's still back channels being worked from all these countries. So nobody wants to be left behind, and if there's a peace accord that's going to take place here, so or even a ceasefire, a peace accord may be a little too strong a word, but certainly if there's a ceasefire, I think that other countries are working behind the scenes in back channels to try to make sure that, you know, everybody benefits with a peaceful Europe. We're all better off. And quite frankly, Russia's better off. You know, they don't need to, you know, as much as Putin wants to thump his chest, he doesn't want to throw 300,000 to 500,000 men at this again, because he knows it does weaken him towards, you know, if for some reason China, let's say, decided to get, or North Korea decided to get skippy and take on Russia. So, you know, none of these decisions are made in a vacuum. It's not just about Russia and Ukraine. It's about everybody. And so I expect that all of them are working the back rooms, back, you know, those little red phones that you see in the movies.
Oh, right. You know, right. No. I understand. I agree wholeheartedly. That is happening. It just seems like the Europeans are desperate to look strong and to have that official seat at the table in the public's eye, because the back channels are happening. I just don't think Trump cares enough. I think Trump's really like, screw you. Y'all won't pay a dime for NATO. We're talking this. So, and this could be Trump's ego. I'm not going to let you guys get a damn dime of credit. And I think they're yearning to get some credit in this whole process after it plays out so they can look strong. Yeah. As Europe, so the European, the EU can look strong as a whole.
I believe this is a different president than we saw in his first term. And we saw it in the campaigns, especially after the assassination attempt, where Donald Trump, you know, is practicing the politics of addition. So I think he is more likely than we think, and what we've seen in the past, of sharing the spotlight if he's able to get his intended result. Because I think he knows that history, you know, this is something that the history books will remember, and he wants to bring peace to Europe. So I don't know that his ego is going to get in the way of a peace in Europe, just because Europe wants to share in the glory of the peace, if that's what you're getting at. I do think he puts his ego in check and keeps his eye on the prize and tries to ring the bell, because that's what's going to be read in history books throughout all time.
I guess I'm viewing it from the perspective the FBI director is at the podium, and he's going to determine if he wants a guy who was in the part of the team to come up to the podium next to him. And so I think the deal gets done either way.
The optics of the picture might matter.
Yeah. And that's what I'm talking about, the optics, because optics are everything to the average person who doesn't keep up. Oh, yeah, Europe is involved. I saw Macron right next to Trump. They don't, you know, so that's what I'm getting to. But I'm beating a dead horse now. Real quick point here. So just today, a father in Odessa shot, and this is still unverified. The story is still coming in. But a father in the video and images are on the internet. A father in Odessa shot and killed Demyan Ganul. He's an Azov member. For those of you who don't know what that is, that's pretty much the Nazi brigade that is in aligned with Zelensky as well. Very powerful faction in Ukraine. He was an Azov member and Ukrainian conscription officer. Reportedly, he was part of the teams, and there's video all over, kidnapping the young and the old and processing them through. The shooter supposedly turned himself in. They're saying that he was the father of one of the kidnapped kids, and it's not gruesome. We've been so desensitized with these big tent, with these movies, you know. So you look at that, and you're like, the movie looks more you know, than the real life. But he took him out. Do you think this is a sign of everything that's transpired since the Oval Office incident, where Zelensky has looked weaker and weaker, and then once we pull the intel, he saw, I can't defend this country? Do you think the people are, because the people really don't want war. They want peace. Do you think they're picking up on this, and Zelensky may be starting to lose his totalitarian grasp on that country?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, to be honest with you, William. It would not surprise me if what you're suggesting is true, but I don't have enough knowledge to suggest that. You know, my guess is that if Zelensky, you know, wanted to put his the hammer down, so to speak, and stay in control there, that he could. But I agree with you that there's only so much tolerance that people will put up with, and so maybe they are coming to the end of it. But I'm not the person to say for sure that that's the case.
To our producer, I'm struggling to hear Jamie a bit. I don't know if that's me or him. So let me know. Jamie, I agree with you. My expertise merely is anecdotal. However, it's pretty important. Being raised and born in Panama, I've seen Noriega when he started to lose that hold. And I've talked to a lot of immigrants and similar stories. So when I saw that, I'm like, that to me was a potential sign. But you're right, we'll never really know until things play out more. But I found it fascinating that he had such a strict iron grasp on that country, and the conscription issue of the kidnapping that's not getting a lot of play, that a father to, and the reason I say that is a father made no bones. He was caught on camera, walked up to him in daylight. You know, this wasn't like a clandestine operation to take him out. It was just an angry father. All right. So, any final comments on that, Jamie, for the audience?
No, I think you covered a lot there. So great job.
Outstanding. All right. So let's get to Tesla under fire.
Tesla on fire?
Literally, yeah. Unpacking the 2025 domestic terrorism. So look, as of today, Tesla domestic terrorism, it describes violent acts, arson, shootings, vandalisms on Tesla dealerships, their vehicles, and the infrastructure in the U.S. And what I didn't realize, this is happening abroad as well. And obviously this is because of the backlash, because Elon Musk is trying to save us some pennies right now as a nation. And for the audience, March 13th, there were shots fired at Tigard, Oregon dealership, the second of that week. In early March, 7 charging stations were torched in Littleton, Massachusetts. 4 Cybertrucks burned in Seattle. Suspects have thrown Molotov, Antifa. Say, don't even bother with suspects. Antifa. Once you say Portland, that's like Antifa land. You know, suspects threw Molotov cocktails and fired rounds. So this isn't simple vandalism, as the progressives in the Democrat Party are trying to say on CNN and on MSNBC. March 2nd, 12 Teslas burned in France. March 5th, a Tesla factory near Berlin. Tesla's brand, they're calling them Nazi cars. So there have been some arrests, you know. So your thoughts on this before I get into some.
It's just incredible that Democrats are literally escalating their criminal activity and trying to say it's under the umbrella of free speech. And to me, you know, violence is never free speech. And Democrats are still, you know, almost applauding this or ignoring it. And so, you know, it's like, oh, well, you know, these violent protests, you know, Black Lives Matter protests were violent. They always say 10% of the protests were violent. Well, there were 5,000 Black Lives Matter protests, 500 of which were violent. Burned buildings, destroyed property, millions and millions of dollars of property, hundreds, maybe thousands of buildings across our country burned. And yet Democrats just almost glorify this activity as political speech. And it's not. It's not political speech. It's not constitutionally protected speech. It is criminal activity. And it's time we start arresting these folks and throwing them in jail for the 10 or 20 years that they deserve to do for having this criminal activity on our streets.
I agree. And just for the record, it was over $2 billion in property damage and buildings and all that across the nation. So it wasn't even 100.
I actually thought that, but I was like, when it was going through my head, I was like, maybe it's not $2 billion. Like, it's just such an incredible large number. And I think the $2 billion are the total of insurance claims, which doesn't even mean them, doesn't even include the minor stuff.
Yeah, and that's not to mention the Black Lives Matter. It was a scam. We're going to talk about that in the hot takes. But and the reason I say that is Minnesota, they literally destroyed the whole region of the city that's literally minority and black-owned businesses. This was just when I say thugs, I mean mob mentality. That mob mentality, you just start destroying anything. You start stealing it. I saw that in Panama during the when the American invasion happened. You know, it was just a free-for-all. It's human nature. And the Democrats knew this was going to happen and allowed it to happen. Now, that said, now Elon Musk claims, and the administration is fighting back, but he's claiming there's some ActBlue-funded NGOs. I like to wait for these things to play out. I've always told our producer, Big John, when these things happen, because you're never going to get the truth from the media. And Elon himself has said that they've made some mistakes. There's so much vast information, they interpret it wrong at times. But he's saying there's five groups, one, Troublemakers, Disruption Project, Rise and Resist, Indivisible Project, and Democratic Socialists of America. So Trump is pushing back too. He actually came out and took a picture supporting Tesla, and they jumped all over him. Now, I wasn't going to do it. I was going to do a different spot, but here's a good spot. He says they're ActBlue and they're funded. Now, we all know a lot of these groups are funded by Soros. People act, no, that doesn't happen here. This is all just naturally organic. Talk to us a little bit about the naturally organic 1960s protests. For those that don't know, I think Jamie may have been there.
Yeah, thanks a lot. No, I may have been born there, but I wasn't wasn't protesting. So, no. Here's the deal. Democrats love to look back nostalgically on this period called the '60s, and like, oh, our protests, they matter. They were against the Vietnam War. They were, you know, nuclear. Just pick a topic. And the truth of the matter is, you know, the vast majority of protests happened in 3 years, 1964, 1968, 1972, you know, and so Democrats go back to the 60s of using violent demonstrations as a way, as a political tool. Now, I truly believe that if we got down to brass tacks and our country really released all the records on what was happening in the 60s, I think you would find that Russia was influencing our elections and influencing those protests then, you know, and some of these folks have just been tools of Russian propaganda their entire political lives. And I know that, that there's a lot of people who don't want to hear that because they feel so nostalgic. So they feel so warm and fuzzy, William, about this period of the 60s and their life and looking.
Jamie, the word you're looking for is romanticize. I apologize.
They romanticize. That's for sure. They romanticize it. And that just gives them the warm fuzzies to feel like they accomplished something through, quite frankly, violence. And that's and so now they move forward a couple of generations, and this new generation is also like, oh, well, of course, you know, if it always you know, the Wall Street protests, the Occupy Wall Street, all of these are funded. You know, how did 10,000 people just show up and get fed?
Like
all of this was funded. And on our podcast, we just released a great podcast with Rosemary Jenks, who is she's a legal immigration expert. But she went into great detail about how our tax dollars were used to provide food, healthcare, transportation, and money to people traveling to our southern border to freely cross our southern border under Joe Biden. And so, you know, this is not new. It's not new for Democrats to use our money to push their political propaganda and then suggest, if we disagree, that somehow we're inhumane. You know, it's just an incredible, just incredible. So,
you're right.
We have to prosecute these folks who are attacking these Tesla, vandalizing these Tesla dealerships, and to the full extent of the law.
I agree. And on your point on the immigration thing, I'm Panamanian, as most of our listeners know, and we got something called the Darien Jungle. Think of Dr. Livingstone in the deepest, darkest of Africa. That's that jungle. And that's one of the main throughways for these immigrants, illegals, to come through. You can't get through there without knowing where you're going and what you're doing. It's that dense. It's that dangerous. It's just that perilous. And I did see one special on it, but my assumption was correct. I'm like, they have to have help to get through that jungle. And that's when I first discovered these NGOs helping them through that. So you are absolutely correct.
And I wasn't trying to dodge your question about Act Blue. We know for a fact that Gavin Newsom tried to raise money for the California fires using Act Blue. Elizabeth Warren has used just recently, I forget who she was raising money for, but it was for some nonprofit and it was running through Act Blue. And so to me, what people need to understand is that Act Blue isn't necessarily getting the money, but the 4 to 5% of credit processing fees are going to a Democrat. It's basically going to the Democrat National Committee.
It's funded.
And so if you give $100, it's like giving a $5 donation to the Democratic Party. And so you think you're giving your money to, and while people know that their money, if they use a credit card, there's a processing fee, but they do not realize that they're making a contribution to the Democratic Party when they're doing so. And Democrats are just being disingenuous. And it's just another way that they look at the American people as their own piggy banks.
Right. And as far as the NGO, so I don't know how true this is, but he is a protester at a Tesla. And this is what he said.
You get paid to be out here?
Yeah.
Amazing. Just some pack.
You really are getting paid for this?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh. Definitely. 100% I'm getting paid for this.
And that's not the only time. Others have said that. Real quick, I want you to comment on the hypocrisy. Obviously, I know where you're going to go with this, but this is just hanging fruit. I just can't let go. Let me show you here. These fools didn't say one damn thing when it was Joe Biden and Jeep, and they're all over for Tesla. Now, to defend Trump, he's gone after and helped companies who have been attacked, whether going after the NFL or helping the steel and aluminum industries. And some of these are direct, some of these are indirect. He's helped other automotive industries to help them out, energy sector. So because of the perception with Elon, I get it. But I got to be honest, I had never been bothered as a child when I saw a president promoting an American product at the White House lawn. It's been done over and over through the generations for a variety of reasons. So real quick, again, I know where you're going. This is low-hanging fruit. What about the freaking hypocrisy here?
It's kind of like, you know, why wouldn't you have the Super Bowl champions come to the White House? Why wouldn't you, every president throughout time, and that's, you know, we had another podcast. My wife and I did one, and she was a guest on your show a few weeks ago. And we talked, we went through seven items where, and she went back to Harry Truman for each one of seven items they're complaining about Donald Trump. I won't go through them all, but that every Democrat president since Harry Truman is guilty of all seven things that they were talking about. Like, you know, whether it's terrorists or whether it's firing government employees or putting a hold on government employees or a hold on hiring or, you know, just whatever the case is. And so it's a 100% political, and it's, you know, I think the American people are seeing it for what it is.
I agree. Okay. So with that said, these attacks, I think they are simply put a form to intimidate, to scare people, so there is no opposition. So progressives and Democrats can just roll their plans and what they want through America without any resistance. If somebody dies, they're okay with it, because in their minds, we're trying to get our plans through, and a few people have to be toppled, so be it. And I think, I truly believe in my heart, they don't care how much damage, what this is costing. Now, on the flip side, if you're into stocks, I'd be buying Tesla right now because it's dropping, but it's temporary because it's not an organic type drop over something they did with something artificial. But what are your thoughts on the fact that they're trying to take away the free speech they're trying to call it free speech, but it's not. They're kind of bastardizing it.
On one hand, they say, hey, we want to burn down Columbia University, and that's free speech. And on the other hand, they are like, we want to keep Tesla from speaking. And we're going to, if you speak, we're going to burn your, you know, we're going to burn your dealerships down. So it's criminal activity. At the bottom line, it's criminal activity. They need to be prosecuted and thrown in jail. It's violent criminal activity. This is not, you know, jaywalking.
Exactly. Now, some of them are already whining. Do you think these people should be prosecuted to the fullest extent?
100%.
I can't argue with that, brother. All right. Now, what do you think about Trump calling them domestic terrorists and hypocrisy again? There is not one documented incident that the DOJ could produce when Merrick Garland said parents at school board conferences were being labeled as domestic terrorists and how the DOJ saw them. Now, nobody raised a finger on what was an obvious lie, and now they're all upset because, as we've seen, the shooting, the vandalism, all of this, the firebombing, all this, that's terrorism. So I see nothing wrong with the domestic terrorism. You've got to stop this. And extreme actions sometimes take extreme measures to rectify. Your thoughts?
You have to make an example of folks who want to use violence for political speech. It's not political speech. It's not constitutionally protected. You do not have a right to it. And you need to, we need to fully prosecute them. And if they have crossed over the level into, I'm not sure exactly what that threshold is from a DOJ standpoint to say it's domestic terrorism. But if they are guilty of or can be charged with domestic terrorism, they certainly should be charged with it and then have to present a vigorous defense in a court of law and prove, you know, and make sure that they are, and then if they're proven guilty of domestic terrorism, throw them in jail and throw away the key.
Exactly. So you kind of already talked about this, but there's they had the hashtag test the takedown, and those are just boycotts and peaceful protests. You brought up Black Lives Matter, 2 billion, blacks and whites murdered, maimed, put in the hospital, some of them with life debilitating issues now. But there's also Antifa. You know, those are all the rich white kids. But the classic that people have conveniently forgotten about is Occupy Wall Street. They saw theft, rapes, and violence there. So when the Tesla takedown hashtag and people say it's just peaceful, how would you recommend our fellow conservatives to counter?
Well, I think the number one thing is to not counter in a violent way. I mean, stay above the violence like we did during Black Lives Matter, and, you know, and make sure that people continue to communicate that this is a criminal activity and these folks need to be prosecuted. That's, I think, the bottom line. The number of people who I personally know in social media who have come back at me and said, oh, no, they have had their political voice taken. Oh, what are you talking about? It is insanity. No, your political voice is not taken. You're not allowed to use your political voice or any – no. There's no constitutional right that allows you to be violent towards your fellow citizens as some sort of protected speech. I mean, it's ridiculous to argue that.
Correct.
And the fact that there are seemingly sensible people who even think that can be argued shows you how far and how much damage – Barack Obama and Joe Biden have done to the psyche of our country.
I agree. And for the people out there, these aren't organic. They're y'all be crying about Elon Musk being a billionaire, but George Soros, Reid Hoffman, Herbert Sandler, Patricia Bowman, and Leia Hunt Hendricks are your own dirty billionaires. And for the record, the ActBlue is under investigation by multiple, I want to say nearly two dozen, if not two dozen, I want to say 30-something, but I know it's more than 12 state attorneys into issues that may be illegal. So this is not going to go away. I think the pushback is there, and I think it's time for the DOJ to begin escalating their probes into ActBlue, into these NGOs, to start prosecuting these individuals. So, I mean, terrorism, is it protests gone wild or ActBlue-driven chaos? You know, let us know in the comments when we post our video here or in the live stream. But I think at the end of the day, we've got to sit there and nip this in the bud, as you said. Quickly, any final word on this before we move on to my
No, brother? I think I've said enough, William.
All right. Let us move on to Mahmoud Khalil. His detention, a clash of free speech, security, and American identity. So Mahmoud Khalil's case is obviously stirring up a lot of noise. We're getting your typical anti-Semitic tropes. We're getting your typical, we're innocent, us Palestinian and Hamas. And the reason I say that is this guy represents Palestinians. I want to play this from Marco Rubio, and I'll pause it a couple of times to get your thoughts on it.
Trump appealed to a lot of Americans during his campaign on free speech arguments and not suppressing speech, especially from the government. But your revocation of the green card, to many, is seen as one of the most anti-speech actions a secretary could take with his powers. How do you respond?
Yeah, when you enter this is an important point, and I'm glad you asked this question. When you come to the United States as a visitor, which is what a visa is, which is how this individual entered this country, on a visitor's visa, okay, you are here as a visitor. We can deny you that visa. We can deny you that if you tell us when you apply, hi, I'm trying to get into the United States on a student visa. I am a big supporter of Hamas, a murderous, barbaric group that kidnaps children, that rapes teenage girls, that takes hostages, that allows them to die in captivity, that returns more bodies than live hostages. If you tell us that you are in favor of a group like this, and if you tell us when you apply for your visa, and by the way, I intend to come to your country as a student, and rile up all kinds of anti-Jewish student, anti-Semitic activities. I intend to shut down your universities. If you told us all these things when you applied for a visa, we would deny your visa. I hope we would.
Right there. See, I like the way he framed that, Jamie, because he's absolutely correct. They come here with these goals. Again, you talk to immigrants who come here. You talk to me. I've seen this in action. I've seen the Panamanian universities, how they would get riled up, how they would purposely do violence. And a lot of plants here, anything wrong. And I didn't like the way he framed the question. It's kind of like one angle. You know, these reporters always take the anti-American angle. Your thoughts so far on how Rubio responded to that question?
Listen, Marco's a pro. I love how he responded. You're a guest in our country. If you act as a guest, you'll be treated as a guest. It's that simple.
Right.
You know,
right.
If you come in our country as a combatant, then you're going to, at the very least, get thrown out of our country, if not thrown in jail. And
right. So
don't come in our country and as a foreign citizen and degrade our country and protest America on our own soil. How right. anybody thinks that that is somehow protected speech by a foreigner to come on our soil and protest the very country that has welcomed them with open arms is just incredulous to me.
Right. And speaking of that, then let me introduce the audience to the topic at hand. So Mahmoud Khalil is a Palestinian graduate student and lawful permanent resident. He's an LPR. He was arrested by ICE. Why?
So, let's make sure. A lawful permanent resident is a green card holder. It's not a citizen. You are still an immigrant. You are still a foreigner on our soil as our guest.
Correct. Correct. So he's accused of supporting Hamas via leadership in Columbia University's pro-Palestinian protests in the spring of 2024. I want to show a few seconds of that video, but there's tons of videos there. It was a terror group. And why do I know it's a terror group? And I'm sure they'll bring this up in court. When Columbia told its Jewish students, you can't come to class, we're going to teach you online because of the terror, because the fear of those Jewish kids' lives. And that's terror. So the Trump administration is via Rubio is seeking deportation, and they're alleging Khalil's actions threaten U.S. interests and align with a terrorist group. And they do. Look, now proving that is one thing. It's like voter fraud. You know, we know it's there, but then proving it per the law of the land is a little bit more difficult. Now, they're saying it's protected First Amendment speech, and that's what they're going to go to battle over. Now, there's about five legal issues that Rubio can sit there and claim, not counting the fact it's within his legal authority as granted to him from the executive branch. Now, that said, Khalil's protest role, his chants, flyers, disruption, and this isn't just simple, hey, here's some flyers. He's out there pushing and promoting the takeover of Hawes, the megaphones in the hat, blaring it, pushing, saying it's okay to be anti-Semitic towards these Jews. And that's how they all were, which is why Jewish kids.
These were violent demonstrations. They were not protected. They weren't protected speech by American citizens.
Right.
So what this guy was doing was not protected speech.
And here's one of this is his group right here. This is 5 minutes. I just want to show a few seconds because it's just 5 minutes of the same thing constantly. So they're moving furniture. They're creating ruckus. They're keeping people from moving back and forth. Now people say, "Well, they're just moving furniture."
They're ripping things off the wall. They're destroying public property.
Right. Okay. I'm gonna keep going. No. And if it was so peaceful and non-aggression, why are they hiding their faces? And James, that's 5 minutes where they just skip through. And that's not talking about how they would spit on the Jewish students, how they would threaten them with hate speech towards them. Everything was anti-Semitic, and he's with a bullhorn encouraging all of this to happen. So my cousin was here on a green card, and they sent his tail back. You know why? He was carrying a gun, you know, which any other American could have in his instance at the house. But the cops like, you're out of here. I ended up having to deal with it. And I'm like, bro, you're done. You're gone.
And there's a movement in the university systems now where a lot of students from the Northeast are going to, quote, the football colleges instead of, you know, like I went to the University of Florida, the Southeastern Conference, one of the best public universities. Dare I say that you get as good an education at the University of Florida with some degrees as you do at Columbia. And this is, more and more people are recognizing those types of institutions and the education that people get. And they're not going to put their children through this kind of nonsense of, and violence and hypocrisy and judgment from people who are supposed guests in our country.
Right. And for the audience out there, there is a Immigration and Nationality Act. I'm not going to tell you the numbers. That's all boring. But there's four of them that he falls under. The inadmissibility for terrorist activity, deportable for security risk, material support to terrorists, transnational terrorism. Then there's the New York state laws of trespassing, assault, kidnapping. And then the one that falls under, various deportation rules. But those four may be a hard sell to an activist judge. And as, ironically, I was producing the show last night and I loved one of the guys. He's like, look, I'm tired and sick of these activist judges. So I kind of see a struggle with this. But at the end of the day, I think it's going to boil down to the Supreme Court going, this is the executive branch's power and their right to do this. I think all this
– this doesn't get to the Supreme Court. There's no question that Marco Rubio is within his rights to remove this guy from the country and, you know, say, get out of here.
There's a great book, two great books. They call her the Tiger Mom. Are you aware of who the Tiger Mom is, Amy Chua? In fact, she had a direct hand in educating J.D. Vance.
You know? I don't know that I do.
Phenomenal book. She's been called racist. She's been called this. She's done various studies on the decay of civilizations. And I agree with her based off my own experience. That's why I always go to the immigrants. I have nothing against American born, have not visited other countries at all. But when you come from countries that have experienced what you see happening here, it's like, hey, buddy, you're fat and happy, and God bless you because you're living the greatest country in the world. But you're fat and happy because you don't think that will happen here. But we have seen it, and we're seeing it, the seeds sprout here. And she kind of talks about that. She argues that nations like the U.S., we risk decline when complacency sets in. The post-1990s, we were unchallenged, and we started having entitlement. It made us soft. She talks about that and contrast that with driven immigrant groups, you know, the Chinese, the Indians, the Jewish who came here and they saw, oh, my God, look at all this opportunity. And they started to do much better than the natural Native Americans. And she wasn't saying that those people were bad. She was saying our complacency is going to allow everything that made this country what it is to dissipate, and then we become a different country. And history has shown when that happens, every civilization has eventually fallen, you know? And what she's trying to sit there and say is, you're having a minority culture flexing their muscle and being allowed to flex their muscle and to begin the destruction of our values. And that's what I try to tell people. You may sit there and say, that's your right, that's your right, that's your right, that's your right, that's your right. No, it's not. Because you have to draw the line over what begins to deteriorate the country's values. It's tough in certain cases. This is pretty black and white. To the women out there who support all this, go look from the 70s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, how far women in the Middle East have come with their dress. And look how they're dressed today. It's literally gone back to caveman. So be careful what you wish for. And what she's saying is we're too compassionate at times. And I agree with that. And you may get on your high horse, your I'm holier than thou, Jesus Christ soapbox, but you're not. You're hypocrites because you don't want to see that you're allowing your nation to be destroyed. For our nation to be open to everybody, we have to draw a line and keep the American value system there because that's what has made us the greatest country in the world. So Cubans, for example, they understand that. You know, Panamanians under Noriega understand that. Serbians understand that. A lot of countries, Ukrainians will now understand that. I saw this with two dictators, with Manuel Noriega and Omar Torrijos. What they do is they turn the locals who once admired Americans against them, and they pitted groups against each other. And I see these similar tactics done in a different way, but the same type of tactics done here to separate Americans from Americans using compassion as the weapon in the quiver for the bad guys. They know how to exploit our weaknesses. And Chua sees this. I see this. It's part of the overall bigger playbook to destroy America from within. Before I give you the floor, I'm going to make one more comment. the Russians in the 70s, I can't remember who the spy was who came over, he said the CCP's goal was to destroy America from within through their education system. And what they failed to accomplish because their empire failed, others are picking right on up. Your thoughts, is Khalil's case signaled this historical repeat of other nations and what the Russians said would be the best way to topple America?
Well, you know, I agree with you. I think I said earlier in the show that, you know, I think Russian infiltration goes back to at least the 60s, probably the 50s, and had a lot to do with the violent protests of the 60s. And, you know, that was Russian instigation to divide us. And certainly, you know, the Palestinian protests, you know, during an election year were trying to divide us and being used as a political and election strategy. And Democrats are always willing to either embrace these strategies or turn a blind eye to them. So, you know, I agree with what you've said, you know, in your, I think I tackled the questions, but if I didn't, let me.
No, you're fine. In essence, it's strategic manipulation. And it just irks me when people accuse me, well, you just don't have compassion. No, on the flip side, I actually do. I have compassion for this country to be around for 1,000 years so everybody else can have the opportunities my mother and father have versus
people. If people want to talk about humanity and inhumane actions, you know, what happened at our southern border was inhumane. The Biden administration losing 300,000 children was inhumane. The Department of Homeland Security said that a large number of those children were either sex trafficked, you know, factory slaves, or dead, or likely dead. I mean, it's incredibly inhumane to just say, oh, we're going to let people come. And by the way you get here is through the southern border controlled by drug cartels that you have to either pay or, you know, do service for once you get into the United States or mule fentanyl to pay the price to get through here. And I'll tell you something, William, I learned from Rosemary Jenks from the Immigration Accountability Project. You know, because Biden's policy was so inhumane, what he said was, hey, we're going to accept all the children, but we may turn the adults around. So parents wouldn't even go with their children. They would send their children to the southern border. And do you know that mothers would give their daughters the morning after pill because there was because the likelihood of them being raped along the way was so high that mothers would give their daughters the morning after pill to, quote, enter the country. I mean, it is – so if people want to talk about humanity and being inhumane, it is Democrat policies that are inhumane.
So, no, I agree. I'm going to close it out here, but I want to make 2 points on what you said. Again, it's strategic manipulation. They've convinced Americans the compassion is them coming here to work for a better life while purposely ignoring everything you've just said, the trials and tribulations to get up here, while also ignoring that some of these countries have let out the worst of the worst, as Cuba did back in the 80s, you know, let the prisons flow. So, and the second point is, he who controls communications controls that country. And the Democrats are aligned with the mainstream media, and they won't report on any of these, the other side of what you're looking at. So I agree with that. So Khalil's fate is up in the air. The courts are going to hash it out. I do believe this will wind up at the Supreme Court because I think there are too many activist judges on the way who are going to want to stick their – they're political. It's like I heard last night, Larry Sharp, great libertarian, said, look, they're all bound to their political party, more so Democrats. And my case in point is SCOTUS. I've yet to see in the last 30 years a Democrat-appointed SCOTUS member go against a Democrat policy facing the court there, the big ones. I'm talking about the big ones, you know. We have to determine legally if he's a security risk or a loud activist. Jamie and I will tell you he's a security risk. And it's a messy clash. And if we could get activist judges out of the way, the problem would resolve itself. And my friends, that's our main gist of our show. We're going to, Jamie, actually, I apologize. Any final words based on what I said?
No, you and I are in violent agreement.
Don't say violent. I'm a pacifist. All right. Let's get our buddy Big John in here. Poor Big John. He's got a, I don't know if he can hear me. Let's see.
There he is.
I'm here.
It's like we feel like we just boarded a cruise ship. What you got going there, Big John? The AC?
No. Actually, I don't hear it anymore. So I don't know. Maybe it's
It's a time warp.
I'll try to fix it in post. Don't worry.
All right. So we have. No, you're fine right now. It's in the background. Mm-hmm. So we have what I like my favorite section with hot takes. So I'm going to be more firm in terms of. I tend to rattle on in terms of what it is. I worked it out in my notes. Bam, bam, bam. And we get your opinions. Remember, the topic at hand is what is to be focused on, because every topic here we can blow up and go at various angles here. For the audience, this is the equivalent of a lightning round. So we call it the hot take. So hot take number one, culture clash. Rap star calls BLM a scam. Rapper Lil Yachty's claim on the cooking show that Black Lives Matter is a scam, alleging the $6 million California compound. BLM says, no, we need that property. We need it for our long-term goals. Okay, the question is the lid finally blowing off BLM's money grab, and will prosecutors ever go after them? Big job.
No, it'll still be a money grab. Will prosecutors go after them? Probably not. It'll have to be some really magnificent bit of fraud if you're talking about just the organizational structure. But for the most part, I think it'll continue. It continues for all political groups.
Jamie, same question to you. But with
they renamed themselves for the 2028 election. I'm not sure what that name will be, but they will continue the fraud, and they will not be prosecuted.
Okay. My take is I agree with both of you. I think they're so brazen, Big John. They may do something so catastrophic. Yeah, because when people are that brazen, they don't think sometimes. All right. Hot take number two, cultural fade, Michelle Obama's podcast flag. So Michelle Obama has a new podcast. It's called IMO. So I'm assuming, in my opinion, with Michelle Obama and Craig Robinson. And before I go on, big apologies to Michelle Obama. I saw her brother, they're like twins. So there is no Michael. It's her brother that we've been seeing. That's a joke, people. Anyway, she launched her podcast, and she has 100 million followers on social media. 14,000 people listen to the second one. Those are paltry numbers. So many now believe that the Obama's relevance is tanking. So the question is, with her podcast literally flopping, bombing, based off her 100 million followers, you combine that with Barack's endorsed candidates consistently crashing since he left office. Are the Obamas yesterday news, and did his condescending push to guilt black men into voting for Kamala prove that they've lost the pulse of America? Jamie.
Yeah, I mean, everybody forgets the $100 million contract they signed with Netflix for I'm not even sure what. And, you know, so now we're learning that, of course, there's fraud, and I think their influence has waned. But how much does your influence wane when you are a billionaire? And I think the Obamas are quickly approaching that.
Big John.
I don't know how much influence. I mean, look, I think she could be very influential. I don't know how many of those 100 million followers are real followers and how many just do it to virtue signal. So that number is meaningless to me. I will say, though, from the reaction of the coordinated reaction of the right-wing social media guys, kind of tells me that they might be a little concerned about her. Like, when I see it on Twitter and everything, it's constantly referring to her as Big Mike, constantly insulting her appearance, constantly, you know, like, harping on that aspect of it being very pejorative, very, very insulting towards her. So is that an indication that she might have some juice left in the tank? Maybe. I don't know. But it'll be interesting to see as she goes forward.
No, Big John, you're right. It's not coordinated. That's just how we gravitate towards her because of how the media's portrayed her, the most beautiful. I'm like, God, you're not even in my top 50 in terms of female first ladies, and there hasn't been 50 presidents. You know, she's a complete fraud in terms of how they portrayed her.
I might put her ahead of some of those ladies in the 1880s. I'll be honest with you.
John, you are absolutely correct. There is some fear in her. It's all this isn't coordinated. It's like you didn't realize it was that bad, if that makes sense. That bad. So I think their influence was never there. They are a product of a media. A lot of their followers, as Big John says, I also believe it's just people who virtue signal. They don't care about him. And I think my proof is Obama has a dismal record with endorsements. These numbers to me are worse than anybody could have thought, but I think it does signify that they are old news, just like Clinton. Clinton now, because of the Me Too movement, is like, why put him out there? So there is some remote. Hot take number four, policy move. Hot take number three, Big John's favorite topic. Another incident of potential voter fraud, Colorado's mail-in ballots. I don't even need to go into it as much as same old story, different place. We'll start with you, Jamie. At what point do Americans wake up and see that voter fraud isn't just possible, but it's happening, and unchecked, unable to verify mail-in ballots like Colorado is experiencing this go-round is just the tip of the iceberg?
Well, I, every time we talk about this, I'm going to continue to try to change the conversation, and conservatives need to talk about supporting free, fair, and transparent elections. And you can have that and have mail-in ballots, but you need to have signatures on the ballot. You need to have them canvassed properly like we do in Florida and have in Florida for 40 years. So yes, but I do think that people are realizing that there's some level of fraud that takes place. Nobody wants to believe it is as large and as impactful as it possibly is.
Ironically, I did my mail-in ballots as a resident of Florida. Big John.
I'm going to be one of those people that Jamie just identified as not believing how big the actual fraud is. So it's not zero. I think you'd be foolish to think there's absolutely zero fraud taking place. I don't think
That's just a statistical impossibility.
Like I said, it's not zero. I said it's not zero. I think if you do believe it's zero, you're fooling yourself. Do I think it's at the level that conservatives tend to blow it up as an issue? I don't. So
certainly where there's same-day registration, that's fraud. Same-day registration is fraud. You know, and then if you have same-day registration and layer in mail-in ballots and no voter ID on top of it, those are all fraudulent laws. They all should be, you know, I've advocated that if you don't have a free, fair, and transparent election like California does not, they take 30 days to count their votes, there's no question that's not free, fair, and transparent. And the one thing Congress can do right now today is say, if you don't have a free, fair, and transparent election, which includes voter ID and no same day registration, that we are not going to sit your members of Congress during the organizational session of Congress. They can pass that rule today, and all of California would have to sit for 48 hours, not be eligible for chairmanships, not be eligible for leadership, and you would get every single state to change these laws to make them free, fair, and transparent.
Right, and Big John, conservatives have never put a number on how much fraud. They just want it investigated, and nobody seems to want to actually do that. And when a state passes a law purposely saying it is illegal, it's not like you don't have to. It is illegal to show your ID when you go to vote. There's only one reason for that, you know. And in fact, they threatened to take a community, a city here, who implemented their own voter ID laws of court, but then somebody got the smarter ID on the Democrat side. Let's just make it a law that it's illegal to show voter ID, and it'll supersede the local cities. So, yeah. Hot take number four. Trump declares English official language. I don't need to get into the hows and whys. It's pretty black and white. Should English be the official language of the U.S. to cement national unity and streamline the current? Big John.
No. It should be the language of government, but it should not be the official language of the United States. The founding fathers saw to that. They saw that there was no reason to do it. They chose not to. they chose not to implement an official language. And why should we? Like, I would remove it from government requirements because that adds cost. But, you know, that's not the reason Trump is doing it, in my opinion. He's doing it because it's part of this MAGA ultra-nationalistic thing, you know, that we're only going to, you know, we should only be encouraged to speak English. That's my take on it. I don't know the specifics of it. But, yeah, that's the way I think. I think it shouldn't be the official language other than for government functions.
Right.
Big John's wrong because we need to make it the official language because, you know, listen, we have a higher percentage of illegal of immigrants in our country now than we did during the Ellis Island days. And so we're bringing in 1.1 million legal immigrants per year, 1.1 million legal immigrants, which is more than we can assimilate. And so you have to do something to try to ensure that immigrants assimilate into our society. And of course, I agree. I believe that we should decrease that number of legal immigrants, stop illegal immigration, and decrease the number of legal immigrants until we regain some balance, just like we did when we closed Ellis Island. You know, we had this huge immigration flux and we had to shut it down because there were assimilation problems, and not having English as the official language is one of the big barriers. And so Donald Trump is 100% correct to make it the official language.
To add on to what Big John was saying, the reason they didn't make it, and I remember my research, I was shocked because I had no clue, there were almost as many German speakers at the time as there were English speakers. And that was one. There was no predominant language and ended up being English.
Jefferson thought ancient Greek should be the official language of the United States because he wanted the elites to run the country. So
gotcha.
Official languages are
like that. Let's stay on topic here. That's what my research brought up. But here's the other thing. Jamie's right. English is the number one language in the world when it comes to business language. Two, to streamline costs, as Big John said. Three, we have factions out there that are telling people, do not assimilate. You know, you don't need to learn the language. To get a better job in this country, you need to learn language. Everything rated as a positive. The ideological beliefs of, no, you don't need to do this, you don't need to do that, is hogwash. This is America. English is the predominant language. You're helping yourself become a better citizen. You're empowering yourself to become a better producer, which means higher wages, et cetera, et cetera. Everything points to a positive of making it happen. And there was a time, maybe not as much anymore, when an immigrant came here, one of their proudest moments was learning English and being an American. So not having an official language at this point, it's not nonsense, but makes no logical sense. Okay, policy win here. I'll take number five. Democrats fold on spending showdown. So the Democrats were saying, we're going to shut the government down, we're going to shut the government down, going to shut the government down. They ended up aligning with the Democrats. I think there were like 8 or 9, maybe, Jimmy, you know how they had more than that, actually a few extra votes over to pass the CR bill to continue funding the government. Why did the Democrats cave on the spending bill when they could have held out for a shutdown? Big John.
Well, for the same reason that Republicans look, this CR is the Biden budget, all right? That's all it is. So Democrats, when they initially opposed it, were being hypocritical because that's what they passed to begin with. Republicans, if they weren't being hypocritical, would have shut the government down. This CR is nonsense. There's only two members of Congress that had the right idea, Rand Paul and Thomas Massey. They voted no. That was the correct way to think about it, and for the correct reasons, by the way, because this does nothing to address the deficit. It does nothing to cut spending. Spending actually goes up with this CR. Waiting till September doesn't help because you're not going to get any extra Republican votes. So nothing changes when this thing needs to pass again in September.
Why did they acquiesce and go with Trump after saying no, they would not?
Because they don't lose. It's their budget. At the end of the day, it's their budget.
You think it was a play all along then?
No. I think they put up a token resistance for appearance's sake. Like, hey, we're against Trump. But at the end of the day, they're hypocrites because it's their budget. They are actually retaining the Democrat budget that was passed under Biden. So why would they object?
Jamie.
Big John is correct.
Wow.
I was expecting that Big John is wrong.
I was almost cringing waiting for that, Jamie. I'm glad to see you.
I did that just for a little curveball, John.
You did it for the optics, Jamie.
I really can't argue with Big John. I think he hit the nail on the head where, you know, we have, Republicans, you know, need to pass a budget. We're $2 trillion in debt per year. And so there's no question that we have to feel some pain and cut that budget out. I think Republicans blinked because the stock market has gone down so much since Donald Trump was in office. So they didn't want to have a huge budget cut right now. And I think Democrats blinked, you know, because they did not have the votes to stand up against Donald Trump. But for all the reasons John described.
You know, I don't think either one blinked. I think they both have a strategy. They're wanting to see played out, and I based that off the economists when I researched on the stock market inflation. They're like, we see what Trump's doing. We're going to wait it out a little bit here before we reserve judgment. So I think both sides are playing it out. Okay, curveball, added question here. Bonus. Sorry, John. I'm sorry, John. But it's mostly for Jamie because you are the GOP strategist. Two instances of libertarians. Justin Amash got blown out. He chose not to run because he knew he was doomed. Massey is actually an entrenched libertarian. Has won, has beaten back his challengers. Where Justin Amash couldn't, Thomas Massey has successfully done that over and over. He's got $1 million in the bank based off of about $300,000 raised over the last week. Jamie, Trump's talking about primary him. Is he just talking garbage because he's angry, or is that a battle they should ignore, or should they take that up?
Yeah, you know, I think Donald Trump should be careful going into the midterm saying that he's going to spend political capital and financial resources primarying incumbent Republicans. And I think that's a bad move, just because he is going to use political capital. He is going to use financial resources. And we know that history would show that he's likely to lose seats. Even if you want to look at this as, quote, Trump's second term, you know, a president loses fewer seats in the midterm of their second term, but they still lose. And so, you know, with the very small minority, you know, even if it's a 12-seat move, you're handing the U.S. House back to Democrats. So I think you hold on to every Republican you can, and you put as much political capital and financial resources on target, which are Democrat-held seats that you think you can flip.
Right. So, Big John, so one thing I love about Larry Sharp is because he and I agree on literally everything. To me, he totes that conservatarian line, even though he claims to be libertarian, and he said it best. It's something I keep trying. The reason I like him is when the libertarian says, I'm like, see, that's exactly what the hell I'm saying. Donald Trump is transactional. You know, at the end of the day, he's transactional. But so is Thomas Massey. He's also transactional based on what the issue is. And my take is, let him be. I actually back him. He stuck to his principles. You just got to deal with a guy who has values and won't sit there and shy away from them like others. But he's transactional. The next issue, you know, you take it for what it is and you try to work with it. Your thoughts, Big John?
Thomas Massey has always voted this way. He's always been consistent. To your point, he is transactional, but the difference between the transactions, in my opinion, between Massey and Trump's transactional issues are overly affected by his tantrums. And in my, it's rough saying this about an 80-year-old, but an immature man. Like, so he'll get upset, not over the fact that what Massey said is wrong, because what Massey said actually more closely aligns to what Trump campaigned on than what he's actually asking him to vote for. So I think it was more the case of he stood against me. He went against me. And in a fit of rage, he said, primary him. And now, of course, all the, you know, the Drainos and the Cat Turds and all these right-wing guys on Twitter, you know, they all go in lockstep to primary Massey, and you can see the, you know, that's one thing. That's the new mainstream media is those guys, right? They just parrot whatever comes from the White House. The key to me is that Elon Musk did not come out and say, I will put my money towards primarying Massey, because that's the key, right? Musk said – I'll put $100 million towards any campaign to get to primary rhinos. That as soon as we identify rhinos, I will fund it. Nicole Shanahan said the same thing. If you go against MAHA, I will fund primary challenges.
She is. Right. She's funding the recall of Karen Bass. Okay, I get you. I'll just push back. Trump is purely transactional. Clinton wasn't charged with. Rand Paul is his bud. Lindsey Graham, he goes back and forth. That's a little bit of the brother. That's a little bit of your TDS because he is emotional. He does throw tantrums. But when the air clears, he's purely transactional. He doesn't go after 80 to 90% of these people. There's a difference between a Thomas Massie and a Rosie O'Donnell. And with the personal stuff. So you've got to understand that about him. And I'm not saying that because I'm a Trump supporter. That's what the facts bear out. Or else he'd hate everybody in Congress because, you know, Congress is very transactional. Hot take number 7. Am I on hot take number 7? We're moving a pretty good clip. Got sidetracked there, but I thought that was a very good topic there, gentlemen. The economic boost, the EPA's historical deregulation. Okay, the EPA administrator, Lee Zeldin, has announced 31 deregulatory actions. That's about what Trump did the first couple of months, and it kind of blew open the economy. And he's dubbed this the largest in U.S. history. It's targeting Biden-era rules, and its simple goal is to open up more energy production, cut the cost for families, and revive the auto industry, and that's aligning with what Trump wants. This worked in his first term, Jamie. The question is, we're not even going to debate the issues of what regs, because I'm pretty sure most of us don't know every reg. But the bottom line there, Big John, you got to check your little tool there. Shouldn't the GOP be shouting at the rooftops what they've done with the proof of how it worked the first time through in his first term, Jamie?
Yeah, I think, you know, the short answer is yes, but the bigger answer is, you know, the environment is one issue that pulls well across demographics. You know, we all want clean water. We all want clean beaches. We all want, you know, some level of protected land that the government owns. And so whether those are state or national parks or whether they're not inaccessible to the public. So I do think that shouting it from the rooftops sometimes may agitate your opponents to a degree where they could get a political win. And so I just say you go for it, let the proof come in, and then claim the victory.
Big John, is Jamie right or wrong?
No, he's right. I mean, the free market will solve all of this, right? I disagree with him. I don't think the government should own anything other than the buildings they're working in. Let the free market figure it out, deregulate as much as possible. But to his point, the issue of third-party damage in the environment is a very tricky one, even for people who are libertarian, who are 100% property rights-based and all that. Like Milton Friedman used to say, is there a role for government if your car exudes particulate matter that I breathe when you drive by? It becomes very difficult to suss that out, especially in a large scale, right? So deregulate, but as a political matter, I don't know why you would mess with environmental protection, quite honestly.
Well, because they overregulate. When you go to the Midwest and there's a puddle and you deem it a water.
No, I get it. But on the larger scale.
Your example. All you have to do is look back at the.
I think you get rid of the regulations. You don't have to dance on their grave.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And like I said, look back at the 70s. Everything was polluted because of capitalism run amok with no safeguards. It's kind of like a kid at a house. You know, you just can't trust them alone. All right. Hot take number 7, health crisis. Another lawmaker lost to illness. This guy is a true blue Chicago Democrat. He's not from Chicago, but he passed away, and he was still tweeting today. Democrat Arizona Representative Raul Grijalva passed away after battling cancer. To cut to the chase here, he hasn't been doing anything for a year. despite being in office. We had the Kay Granger with the mental dementia for 6 months. We had three Sheila Jackson. We have Donald Payne Jr. We have a whole string of these. They get sick and they don't come back. I view it. They don't want to let go of power. They know they're ill, but they run anyway. And then the cancer overcomes them or mental illness. They're just too old. So the question is, with Grijalva, Jackson Lee, Payne, Turner, and Granger, they're all permanently out the past year, not being able to do their jobs. Should Congress look at doing something, or should we just go, hey, tough luck, you voted him in, you're stuck with no voting until the next election cycle? Big John.
Well, of course you should do something. Yeah, of course you should do something, but for the same reason that you're not going to get rid of activist judges is the only mechanism available to you is comprised of the same political body that you're trying to reform. So, you know, you have to impeach judges. You would have to censure and impeach your own membership if you're in the House. Who's going to do that? Because the second you agree to do that, it could turn on you. And these people, the last thing they need is job insecurity in their mind. So it's never going to happen.
Your point is it should, but it's not happening. Correct. No, I agree. Jamie.
I'm going to say it should not happen just because we don't need a bunch of politicians determining who is healthy enough, whether, because then it gets into, oh, are they emotionally healthy enough? Are they mentally healthy enough to serve in Congress? And, you know, then the question becomes who determines that? And you look at a Congress like we have today and you have eight members. Well, Democrats could say, oh, there's 10 emotionally, you know, incapacitated Republicans, and we need to kick them out. And somehow they're, you know, even if you have a third party body who then deems that, now you've had a switch. Now you've overturned what the voters wanted. So I think it should not happen because it's a slippery slope, and we just have to suck it up. You know, in Florida, we have two open congressional districts right now. We're filling them. These other places can fill their districts, and it's not the end of the world.
Jamie, would you support something? Not that I do. I agree with you for the most part. But what about something like the mechanisms of the 25th Amendment, but just applied to members of Congress?
Well, that's just saying he can't.
Sorry. My issue, the devil's in the details. Who is signing that? At least when you're talking about the 25th Amendment, you're presumably talking about a president or someone, and then cabinet members who that president appointed. And so you're saying even the people who are most loyal to this president have agreed that things have gone so far south, either health or emotional or whatever, somebody has a stroke, that they can no longer serve. And so who becomes that body in, let's say, the U.S. House? And I don't know that you keep politics out of that.
You know, I think both of you guys are right. And to use Trump is a sound mind. You may not like him, but there is no doubt he has it together. And they wanted to use the 25th against him last cycle. They kept pushing that. And then here's Dementia Joe, who obviously was incapacitated, and they now admit that, and they refuse to look at it that way. So as much as I agree wholeheartedly with John, but then if I was a politician, it'd be like, well, Jamie actually gives me the ugly truth. You know, because games will be played. All right, media bias. Topic number eight. I mean, it's sad. It's like it's just they don't represent the people anymore. They represent their parties, you know, and what they can get out of it. And that's the ultimate sin. And I'll leave it at that. I was ready to go on a rant. So, hot take number eight: and media bias. NPR's Pride event flip flop. Okay, so I'm going to read through this one a little bit because there's a lot of nuance. So NPR initially barred anchor Ari Shapiro from attending the corporate LGBTQ A through Z Pride event, and there's rules. The NPR has rules in place in terms as to not show or be seen being biased. Then the email accidentally went to everybody, and the rabble-rousers at NPR started throwing a fit. So NPR allowed him to go, but there is a rule. The guidance in our ethics handbook is to avoid appearances at private industry or corporate functions. And that came from the managing editor for standards and practices. So they broke the rule because of pressure from NPR citizens. Now,
should NPR have the right to block an anchor or anyone from any event tied to his job, meaning that going to that event will show a bias if it risks tainting their already shaky claim to objectivity? Part one, Big John. Hold on, that was Little John, Big John. Big head, big spine. Go ahead.
I'm gonna have to be honest with you. I'll cede my time to Jamie first because I'm working really quick on these issues here. So Jamie, why don't you answer first, and then I'll jump in.
Yeah, you know, number one, NPR should be defunded. We should not have publicly funded propaganda radio and TV stations.
Jamie, that's part two of the question because I knew we were going to go there regardless. The part one,
we're definitely there. He should have to abide by his contract. So if his contract says he cannot attend, he should not attend.
Exactly. Okay, go to part two. My question for the part two is because NPR is on shaky ground, is so biased. Were they trying to play by the rules to protect themselves from Donald Trump?
I hope they can't protect themselves from Donald Trump. I hope that we defund them and we stop the political propaganda with our tax dollars. That's what NPR and PBS has been. They hide their corporate profits through, many, many ways. And, anytime they have a commercial success, it's, oh, the corporation's over here, but our tax dollars still go to fund all this. And it's, as I like to say, BS.
Big John.
Yeah, I really can't disagree with anything Jamie said. you live up to your contract that you voluntarily signed, and we should deregulate or defund, rather, PBS, and anything that supports the arts should be defunded.
The reason I wanted the first part answered is because it is a company's role and job. They have a right to do that to their employees for all the bleeding hearts out there who says he has rights. In the military, I cannot go, or when I was in the military, I cannot go to, say, a protest or things like that. And then the Democrats allow that to be broken, and it opened the floodgates. It just creates chaos. All right. Number nine. Okay, Jamie, can you hear me pretty well?
I can.
Okay, so John, I think that's maybe on your end then.
Go ahead.
Okay, so number nine, safety scandal. DEI activist caught rigging exams. So on March 12th, Shelton Snow, a DEI activist and FAA air traffic operations supervisor, was caught on voicemail allegedly offering black candidates cheat sheets for air traffic control exams, excluding any white candidates from seeing what he was giving to the black candidates. He goes, I've taken a screenshot of valuable information. Then he comes back with, I'm 99.99% sure it's exactly how you need to answer. Again, excluding white candidates to minimize competition. The question here is, should Shelton Snow just be fired for rigging air traffic exams for his preferential race, blacks? Or does this sabotage actually deserve a criminal investigation because it falls under fraud, conspiracy? But even worse, the big thing is a danger if you have an unqualified person manning the air traffic control station. I think that's a bit of a reach, but it is an issue that's come up. Big John.
That's a tough one because I don't know the nature of what – look, I've been in the corporate world my entire life, right? And we all know there's certain types of exams you're forced to take for government regulation purposes. We all pass around screenshots to each other because we know it's a waste of our time and you just have to do a pro forma thing. It's a rubber stamp and you get past it. We don't do it for things that affects our job. So in the case you just cited, I don't know, were these things that he was doing potentially putting through unqualified people, or was it just...
It's like a bar law. It's like your securities become a financial planner. It's those type of tests where what you know will determine if you can advance. It's not one of these human resource, everybody has around.
So if it was a competency, if it was a test of competency and he cheated on it, it doesn't matter who he cheated for or who he excluded, He should probably be fired. It's probably in his employment agreement. So, yeah, I agree. He should be gotten rid of. I don't think criminal charges are warranted, but, yeah, he should be fired.
Right. So, Big Jamie.
I agree. I agree with John. You know, the only thing I would suggest is if, in fact, he put forward people who were unqualified because they cheated and they created an unsafe environment that led to a crash, then he's criminally liable.
Oh, sure. If that can be proven, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
But there's a lot of ifs in there.
Yeah, yeah. And also the people who accepted his help might also be properly dismissed for cheating as well. So even though they didn't take the screenshots, I would agree that by accepting those screenshots, they also are considered like in some violation in school we called it an honor code, right? It doesn't matter if you took the crib notes or you just got somebody else's crib notes, you still got booted, right? So I think it should be the same thing here.
Yeah, I agree with both of you guys. The reality of it, that was the entrance exam. So they still have a ways to go to pass. So I hope that by the time they get to the level they pass, they're qualified. But, yeah, he should be fired. And I think at this point, with the way DEI, with the way we've had racism, tribalism, sometimes you need to make an example. And I don't care. When it was white racism, we made examples of those people. So, and as a Latino, I'm like, I always viewed racism as racism because every color was in my family. So whatever the repercussions, because there is no hate crime here. I looked that up. Is this more of a hate crime? And it doesn't, because hate crime is more violent crime. There was no violence here. But they should investigate it. And sometimes you got to make an example of somebody so it stops others from doing that. Final question. Geopolitical shit. Greenland's election upset. The right came out and won more than ever. The lefties are no longer in charge. It's more of a split type government. This is more of a fun question, I guess. With Greenland's new government leading pro business and pro US, is this a serious shot at a strategic alliance with America or just more social media noise for the left to spin? Or both sides to spin. We'll go to Big John, then I'll answer, then we'll let Jamie close it out.
Yeah, I mean, look, to me this is nonsense, but I don't know because, like, I mean, what does right and left mean in Greenland? I have no idea. Like, if you told me what a right-winger or a left-winger is, like...
Let me jump in. Okay. They didn't say right-winger or left-winger. They said it was a more pro... It's a side that's more pro-Trump than the other side. That's all they said.
Okay, well, that still doesn't mean anything to me politically, but does it mean anything to me? Probably not, until I have reason to be worried about Greenland, and I have zero reason to be worried about Greenland. I don't want them to be our 51st state. I don't think we should send our troops there or whatever Trump is thinking of doing. So to me, it's just noise.
Actually, it's not about them becoming a state. My take is it's about an alliance. And believe it or not, when I researched it out, Greenland's been wanting to secede from Denmark forever. And this is a more pro-Trump, and we'll see how far this goes, because an alliance could be set up. But I think this is more fun fodder for the internet. I think this is just Trump's bombastic way of talking and maybe create some kind of strategic alliance to benefit the U.S., which I think is all you want. Same thing with the Panama Canal. Mr. Tammy, you get the final
president. President Truman was the first president that I'm aware of who actually tried to negotiate Greenland away from Denmark and was told no. And so I think that, you know, and that it was for the same reasons we're talking today, is that it's a pretty important, or it will become a pretty important piece of political dirt, if you will, that, you know, or to protect our country and protect shipping lanes and all of the things that we're discussing today is why we want to help or have Greenland become a state. I agree with John. I don't think it becomes a state, but it's certainly in our national interest, and to have people there elected who agree with some of our national interests, I think is more helpful than not.
You know, you made me realize something, and Big John talked about it. You know, Trump does have a big ego, and he's looking at he's looking at his legacy. But again, it's like the Central Park Five. Oh, Trump. It was all of New York. I thought they were guilty. You know, every president looks at their legacy and what they want to accomplish so they can be remembered folly. Trump just goes at it quite a different way. And with that, my friends, I want to thank Big John for joining us with Hot Takes. And we are concluding. Our episodes seem to be getting longer, but good info. I'm trying, people. I'm going to tighten them up for y'all. But I thought it was another good episode. Jamie, a lot of great takes. Obviously, our issues with Mahmoud Khalil is more about the future and the value system of what America represents and losing that with Tesla, the hypocrisy. Democrats see it one way as a peace-loving protest that are truthfully vandal. It's terrorism by definition. And the very first topic, the Ukraine, I do think a ceasefire will happen. Well, how it goes down, though, once it happens, we don't know. John, thanks for being on Hot Takes. For the rest of the audience, you can check out this work at grumblingsmedia.com. Bookmark it there. And you can also check us out at YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, and Pandora under the profile Grumblings Media. And I apologize before I do let you go. Big John, real quick, tell us about your two shows, and I'm going to go to Jamie to plug his stuff.
Oh, all right, and looks like my software's frittering, so it's Little John again. But check out Liberty Lens. Every Thursday it drops. Me and Mike Tremont pick one issue, and we talk about it for the episode of Interest to Libertarians. And also streaming live every Thursday night at 10 p.m., Free for All. We just aired our 50th episode last night with special guests Larry Sharp and Mike Tremont. So that'll be up this weekend on grumblingsmedia.com. So check it out. And thank you, William, once again for having me join your Hot Takes.
That was a great episode last night. I did have to direct them. Get off the TDS! Get off the TDS! Yeah, Larry Sharp and Tremont know their stuff inside and out.
And ironically enough, it wasn't me with the TDS last night.
No, it was not. And I'm only teaching. It was just it was a very short bit. But Jamie, to y'all, has a great show he's going to tell us about. But I got to toss this in there. When I see them, I think, say goodnight, Gracie. Do you remember that, Jamie?
Yeah, I do.
George Burns. Exactly.
So, yeah, my wife and I have a podcast, Reasonable Arguments. I also write a Substack under that same name, Reasonable Arguments. My wife and I, we try to break down the complex issues. You know, I'm a political expert. She is not. She is brand new to politics, basically, because she fell in love with me and decided to marry me. And so... So we really try to break it down. We're right now in the middle of a four-part series on legal and illegal immigration. Our second episode drops, I think, Sunday night. And we have Ed Rollins, former White House political director and Ronald Reagan's campaign manager, who is scheduled for an upcoming episode. And, you know, should you be looking for a corporate speaker? I do all of that as well. And I'm an author of American Speeches That Changed History. So we're doing a lot of things. And thanks for having me on, William. Big John, it's always a pleasure. You always help sharpen the knife with your great comments.
Jamie, give me your website.
Okay, the website is reasonablearguments.com. That's kind of the portal where you can find all of our stuff. We also are on all the podcast channels, but you can find us information on all of that at reasonablearguments.com.
And with
thank you, John.
And with that, my friends, thank you for tuning in. I am William Del Pilar for Big John and Mr. Jamie Miller. And until next week, this has been Fired Up. We shall see you soon.